We've done enough for Joe in our house. We were thankful that we had him for the couple of weeks that we had him. When you hear people saying, they get over it and this and that, not when they are dying, they don't get over it. So we cared for Joe in our home. We washed him. We gave him baths. We shaved him. We weren't afraid to put our hands on our son because we loved our son and we still love our son.
There was no stress. There was no rattles. There was absolute. This is why the shock of it, that I can't accept that. I just couldn't believe that he had died, because I was waiting for all these signs, because I had seen people dying and I knew what it was, the stress, and there was absolutely nothing. And that only thing that keeps me going, the way he died, I believe our son went straight to heaven.
Our aim is to help each patient not only to die peacefully, but to live with dignity until he dies, and for the family to go on living afterwards.
I wouldn't have any hesitation in saying that it's being at home that makes it life worth living.
The last memories would be of a boy who was holding on to life with all the fibre that he could muster.
People are always asking, you know, what is the good death? What does dying with dignity mean? Dying with dignity means dying in character. I think this is wonderful, because I don't think any man or woman should change their personality or their lifestyle or who they are when they come to die, because dying is an act of life. It's just one of the acts along the way in your life. And I think this is very important for families to know, because sometimes families can be very protective towards the dying person and can try and set up a kind of an ideal environment for the dying person. And very, very often I'm having to say to people, give him room, give her space.
That dying in character with as normal a lifestyle as possible that Christy Kennelly talks about is very much the hinge on which the hospice home care service functions. Christy Kennelly trains carers in communication skills. He specialises in the terminally ill. The symptom control unit set up by the hospice in the mid-70s enabled the symptoms associated with cancer to be controlled. The home care unit, established a decade later, was a natural progression. This made it possible for people who were dying to be cared for by their families in their own homes. Sister Ignatius is director of the home care team.
We're a symptom control team aiming to keep patients comfortable in order to live the last period of their lives to the full. We do not treat the patient in isolation, but the family unit as a whole. We try to cope with their emotional and psychological feelings. And we help the family in their care and the support of their loved one. We encourage the patient, once symptoms are controlled, to be in charge. And sometimes that isn't easy, to get the family to draw back. They've been so used to looking after their loved one that they just can't believe they're feeling so much better and they're able to get up and perhaps wash the dishes or go for a walk or whatever. So we encourage the patient, once symptoms are controlled, to be in charge and to have a quality of living. We aim that they can set at them setting realistic goals. Now, they can be very simple goals, such as going for a walk in the garden, or perhaps around the block, or perhaps going to the local for a pint, or maybe going further afield, going out to dinner, or going away for a weekend. We've had quite a number of patients who've been able to go for holidays, not only in Ireland, even to Spain, and enjoy themselves to the full.
People who have cancer may suffer from breathlessness, nausea, dizziness, and of course pain. Removing pain and the fear of it is an integral part of the home care service, as medical director Dr. Verone Hanley explains.
When people with cancer first hear about their condition, naturally they're very frightened and fearful, and as are their families. And I think one of the biggest fears that they have is the fear that because they have cancer, that they will have pain. In most people's minds, pain and cancer are synonymous. They just go together. And that needn't necessarily be the situation at all. Because pain isn't always present to begin with if a person has cancer. Many people live with their cancer, and if cancer is the cause of their death, they die without experience pain at all. But when pain is there, when pain is part of the disease, it's heartening and comforting to know that any pain can be controlled.
Because the patient is going through a sense, perhaps, of isolation, depression, a feeling of loneliness, and may not be able to discuss that with their loved ones because they don't want to worry them. So that we bring all these qualities of a living relationship to enable that person to feel safe, secure, and confident in the knowledge that we have taken all that and placed it on our own shoulders. All these problems, all these worries.
Pain isn't always a physical thing. We must always appreciate and understand that, because part of pain is the emotional part of pain. It's the fear of pain. So we have to appreciate that when we're undertaking the management of pain. But to deal with physical pain, there are many medications. Prime amongst those are narcotic drugs, or morphine. And properly used and individually managed, people can take the appropriate amount of morphine and live very well. It's like a person having diabetes. They need insulin to control their diabetes in order to live fully. Likewise, when a person has pain, they need their morphine to take their pain away in order that they can live very fully. So people needn't be afraid that of morphine, or that by taking morphine their mental state will be interfered with, that they will become drowsy or confused. That isn't so. Morphine takes away the pain and allows them to live very well, mentally alert and as full of life as their disease will allow them to be.
I think there's a great sort of protective instinct in all of us towards those we love. I think this makes us highly protective of our children. It also makes us highly protective towards our loved ones who are terminally ill. I remember when my own father was terminally ill, and now I'm supposed to know something about this area, but he took me out for a walk at one stage, and it was just the day my son had been christened. And as we walked around the block, he said to me, "Isn't it a funny old world, you know? There's your fella coming and me going." And I turned on him straight away and I said to him, "There's plenty of room for the two of you, and don't be talking like that." And you see, I, no more than anybody else, I don't want my father to die. I don't want to let him go. And part of our bereavement starts, I think, there and then, when we begin to realise that the rock is wearing. And it's a growth process for ourselves too. It's coming to terms with the fact that, yes, they are going to leave us, and to give them the freedom and the room to do it the way they want to do it, and to allow them to take control of their own dying in as much now as they can. So that, again, we don't kidnap them, and we don't take responsibility away from them, and we don't make them, in a sense, dependent upon us. That they have the freedom, and I remember my dad felt that he had the freedom to sit down and tell us where he wanted to be buried and the basic arrangements that he would like to have. And in lots of ways, he gave us the freedom to grow through his dying. And he created the kind of environment within the house where we could laugh, or we could cry, or we could just be ourselves. And many people are afraid that if their loved one knows that this is a terminal illness, that the time remaining will be terrible, that everybody will be in bad form and that the only thing to talk about will be death. In fact, quite the opposite was our experience. In fact, it liberated us and it gave us the freedom, as they say, to talk about nothing at length and to have the old crack and the laugh and at times, if we wanted it, to have the cry. But there was no hidden agenda. There were no barriers put up. There was no strain. We didn't have to act when we went into the room. He didn't have to act for our sakes as well. And I remember a line from Shakespeare where Malcolm, the young king, says about a man who has just died. He said, "Nothing in his life became him like the leaving of it." And I could certainly say that one of the great things my father did in his dying was teach us how to live.
Given a choice, I think most people would choose to stay at home to die. Thinking of my own situation, I remember my mother, she died from lung cancer. The end was coming and she knew that. And in those days, people went to hospital to die, and I can vividly and clearly remember her going around to all of the rooms and recollecting all of the things that happened and going through the memories, the sweet ones and the not so sweet ones. And for me, it was as heartbreaking as it must have been for her. I think that certainly did encourage me and stimulate me in my younger days to want more, so that people could get as much care from a medical point of view as much as from a nursing point of view, to allow them to stay in their own comfortable final home surroundings, so that they don't have to make that final break and that death slips upon them rather than they having to say their last goodbyes to die.
I wouldn't have any hesitation in saying that it's being at home that makes it life worth living.
Martin Ronan took early retirement 5 years ago from the civil service. On the 7th of June last, he had an operation to remove a cancerous tumour from his upper spine. Since then, his lower body has been paralysed. 3 months later, he was discharged home from the rehabilitation centre with a bed, a hoist and a wheelchair. A few days later, the hospice home care team moved in. Martin's symptoms were assessed. Then in consultation with his GP, his nausea, breathlessness and coughing was controlled. He is being cared for at home by his wife Eva and daughter Mary. There's a great atmosphere in the Ronan household. There's a lot of laughter, a lot of joshing and a lot of caring. Talking directly to her husband, Eva remembers the dark days.
Well, first of all, after you had your operation and we were told that you were paralysed, we felt devastated. We were wondering how you'd manage at all. And most of all, we felt for you, because the shock of it must have been terrible altogether to cope and to feel so helpless. When you went into St. Luke's then, I went in and I saw you in this rotating bed, and I felt, oh gosh, we won't ever be able to manage it all. After that, then you were sent to the rehab, and it wasn't quite so bad. But it was awful to see you so helpless, having to be turned ever so often so that the bed sores would heal up. Then I knew then that you would like to come home, but we were worried that would we be able to cope when you'd come home as regards turning you and dressing you and everything. But thanks be to God, we managed.
At the moment, I haven't any hope of being able to walk again. A miracle may happen at any time, but medically, and from what I've gathered from the surgeon, that the movement is not going to come back. And the only time that I can walk now is when I'm asleep, is at night time. I'm always up and about at night, and I go all kind of places. And at the back of my mind, even in the dreams, I have a feeling that I shouldn't be there. But it's only when I wake up in the morning that I realise that things are the same as they have been.
get up about 9 o'clock in the morning, and we tidy up a bit, and then the nurse comes to help us to get Martin dressed, washed and dressed. And sometimes we get him and put him in the chair. Lately now he's inclined to be feeling a bit sick when he'd get up, so we leave him lying on for a while, and Mary, my daughter, is around, and we can get him up then at his own pace, and he's better able to cope then, because he's inclined to get a bit sick if you get him up too quickly, you know. So after that then we kind of coax him as to what he'd like to eat, and he's a great fish man, and he's very particular. We have to get really fresh fish or we're sacked. Now he'd tell us if it's not fresh. So we have to be very, very careful not to bring home any fresh fish that isn't fresh.
I'm an expert potato peeler. I can take off the least amount of skin off a potato of anybody that I know. And if it was a sport, I would have my claim. But one way that I can be helpful to him is by taking a huge basin of washed potatoes onto me knees and getting onto the job of peeling them. And I do that with great thoroughness, and I drop them into a bucket of water. And this time of the year they keep for quite a long time peeled. It doesn't do them any harm. But it's quite useful. And I find now that I'm being inveigled into the job of peeling potatoes for, if not for the neighbours, at least my sons who are living away from home. You know, it's a help. I can clean carrots and parsnips too with some efficiency. And it's time and again when there is a need for chips, that having the potatoes ready peeled is a great help. Just to take them out and dry them and chip them saves the need to start off washing and peeling, which certainly takes up the greater part of the time in the business of making chips.
First thing in the morning after he has been dressed and washed and dressed, is that he demands that he has his Times. And not alone does he read it, but he tells me all the news that I don't even have to read the Times. But I will say one thing about Martin, that at any time, never have I seen him in bad humour. That he's a wonderful person altogether. That he has taken it, everything, so placidly. I know if it was me, I wouldn't have been able for it, what he has gone through.
Before I got ill, Mary had ordered the rug plants materials, and she had started a handmade rug, or a rug which is intended to be a handmade rug when it's finished. But I'm intending every day to start on, because it's very suitable work for me. It means just sitting at the table, stitching in one stitch after another with the aid of a little, what do you call it, a hook.
Well, when Daddy came home in September, it was great, because it was just like having him back like before. And then at Christmas time, everybody was here, and it didn't mean that we had to go out to hospital, or it was just having everyone together. And it makes all the difference. But apart from Daddy being a really chatty person, be able to tell you all about history and about what's on the paper and the news of the day and jokes, be up sometimes before we got the Pegasus mattress, and I had to get up early hours in the morning to turn him, and he'd have a different joke or a story or something to say. And also the fact that he still writes the checks for all the different bills coming in. So, like, it's as if it's just the same as before, being home again. And you forget of him being paralysed, and you just take him as a person and not of his illness.
Another man who was cared for at home and eventually died was Joe Carthy. He was 29 years of age and had AIDS.
His brother used to be up there sitting with him, and he told his brother what he wanted, that he wanted to die, only with me and his dad and his brother. There, just the four of us. And the house was always full. People were coming and going all the time, all his friends coming in and out to him. And he chose that night. The house was empty from half, about 11:15. And 11:15, he died. He chose that time when he knew it was only us there. And people say, like, you know, God help, but we were the lucky ones in the end, because had he been in hospital, we wouldn't have experienced what we did. We were able to tell one another we loved one another. He told us he was sorry for all he had done and the trouble he had given us, which he hadn't. And we were able to tell him we loved him. And we had the pleasure of being in my arms, telling us he loved us, and seeing his spirit leaving his body and going out the window. We were waiting on stress, and there was nothing. He got the most beautiful death that I've ever seen, I've ever experienced.
We never knew that Joseph would contact HIV. Joseph was a loving boy. He was full of life. He went out, he enjoyed himself. He brought friends to our house. They enjoyed us out in the house, having tea, and just having a bit of a laugh between us all. But Joe was special. In Joe's name, Joseph, it goes J, he was jolly. O, he was optimistic. S, he was sociable. E, he was electrified. P, he was popular. And H, he was happy. So what more can I say about Joe? That was Joe to us.
Joe was... He was just an average, ordinary child, playing around, doing things everyone else done. He was always at me back. He was always with his mother everywhere I went. Joe was there with me. We were very snug. We thought we were an average family. I have another son. There's just the four of us. And then my son got married. We had Joe there with us all the time. Joe went away to London. When he was about 19, he came back. After a while, he used to be ringing me and saying he was lonely, he missed us, and he missed our granddaughter. And so he came home, and he was here, and he was walking here, and he was walking there. Joe was a very colourful person. He loved life. He loved jewellery. He was never in. He went out, and when you saw him, that was it, you saw him. I didn't know he was sick. I didn't know this was going to happen to us, and... He never told us.
When we found out about Joe, he was in James's hospital, and said the doctor could do no more for him, so we took him home to care for him in the house. We did care for him. We'd done enough for Joe in our house. We were thankful that we had him for the couple of weeks that we had him. When you hear people saying, ah, they get over it and this and that, not when they are dying, they don't get over it. So we cared for Joe in our home. We washed him. We gave him baths. We shaved him. We weren't afraid to put our hands on our son, because we loved our son, and we still love our son. So, dying, Joe dying, and it's in the Bible. You are born to die. So, when you are dying, that is still over your head. We can't get away from that. We all have to die some way or another. No matter what way we die, we'll die.
Just 8 days before he died, that we got the nurse in, and she was fantastic. She was very, very good, though he dreaded to see her. He used to know that she'd be making him clean his teeth and what had you, and I used to push him to do that because I knew he wasn't well. I used to lie in the bedroom at night. He'd be in his bed and I'd be outside of his covers, and I'd have a duvet over, and his dad would be in the rocking chair, and that's the way the three of us slept. 2 weeks before he died, we slept that way every night.
The day Joe died, Teresa, the district nurse, visited him in the morning. She called back again at lunchtime and suggested that it might be advisable to get a night nurse.
I think Joe realised then that it was finished. Joe wouldn't have wanted night nurses coming into him or anything. So Teresa was going down the stairs and she said, "I'll see you later, Joe." He says, "Please God, you won't." So she says to me, "Joe was giving up the fight." So he was kind of in a, not a coma as such, but he was asleep and he was, you know.
The day passed slowly for the Carthys. Joe's mother watched out for the nurse from the sitting room. When she came back upstairs, she found that Joe had quietened down.
And this noise he was making, you know, moaning, was gone. I said, "Oh, God, thank God, he's asleep. He's in a deep sleep, you see." So my son said, "Go down, ma'am, make the supper tea and have everything ready for the nurse." So I went back out on the road, and next she came in, and I says to her, "You can't go up with that uniform on you." So she says, "I'll just go up and have a look at him." And I walked in. She walked into the bedroom with us, and I just looked at my Joe, and I knew he was drawing his last breaths. So the nurse said, "Kneel down." And I just walked over, and I just took Joe in my arms. And I was saying the prayer to the Sacred Heart that I'd always said for him and our Blessed Lady. So I just took him in my arms, and he looked up at me, and he just melted that he loved me. He just said, "I love you." You know, he just melted it, you know. And with that, he just gave the three sighs. And it was absolutely beautiful. We actually felt, saw his spirit leaving his body and going out the window. There was no stress. There was no rattles. There was absolute. This is why the shock of it, that I can't accept that. I just couldn't believe that he had died, because I was waiting for all these signs, because I had seen people dying and I knew what it was, the stress, and there was absolutely nothing. And that only thing that keeps me going, the way he died, I believe our son went straight to heaven.
The Hartnett son, Peter, was 7 years old when he died at home of cystic fibrosis.
The night of his death, right through the night, the early morning, the last few hours of his life, about an hour before he died, he called out, "Mommy, Mommy." And later I felt that hope that one of those mummies was calling on his Blessed Mother, on our Blessed Mother, whom he loved very much. And I do believe that at the moment of death, that the room must have been filled with dozens of angels and all the saints that he loved.
John Hartnett remembers his son's death more as a holding on to life than as a gentle going.
The last memories would be of a boy who was holding on to life with all the fibre that he could muster. And so I'd get a couple of hours sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning, to then be called at 5 o'clock by Yvonne telling me that she didn't think Peter was going to pull through. And to then put my hand beside his heart to feel that the heartbeat had in fact changed, and that our little boy, who for a long time had had a heart which was racing, now had a heart which was beating softly, and a gaze in Peter's eyes which was saying that he couldn't really fight for much longer.
And so it was a very unreal time for us. Hard to believe that Peter in my arms was, this lifeless body was the little boy that was so full of life. And that he was always trying to get us going when he must have seen us looking so miserable sometimes, which I'm sure we did. We tried to hide it from him, that when we were talking about his illness, we wouldn't talk in his presence in a miserable sort of way. But I'm sure he must have seen our faces. But he'd always be saying, "Come on, let's do something," or "Let's have a cup of tea," or "What should we do today?" And he rarely gave in to the illness, which really, in the last few weeks anyway, must have caused him a tremendous amount of suffering which we would never have, we will never know what suffering he had, because he certainly never complained.
When Peter was here in the front room after he had died, it wasn't for me a case of him being dead and gone, but a case of feeling that I'd come into the room and quite possibly Peter would sit up very quietly, as he would sometimes when he wasn't well, and you'd say to him, "How are you?" And he'd say, "I'm fine." And I could see him sitting up and saying, "Hello, Daddy." And I'd say, "Well, whatever." And he'd say, "I'm fine."
We wanted to make sure that we were making the right decision by keeping Peter at home. In fact, a week and a half before he died, when he had a hospital appointment, and John went in with Peter. It was actually the feast of the feast of All Saints. In fact, it was John Patrick's birthday, his brother's birthday, and John had to go into the hospital with a cylinder, which was a dangerous thing to do, but we had no option really. And we had decided at that point, knowing that on seeing Peter, that the doctor would be saying, "This child is very ill and needs to be in hospital," they were already aware that we preferred to have Peter at home, and we'd made a decision that unless they could do more for Peter, we would prefer to have him at home. In the last few days of his life, I wanted to check again just to make sure that we were doing the right thing by keeping Peter at home, because he was happy at home. He loved being at home, and although the hospital was great and they did all they could, they did all they possibly could to help him all through the years, he preferred to be at home. So I rang them to say, have we made the right decision? Is there any more you can do for Peter? And we were told, no, there's nothing more we can do for him. You're doing all you can. And if you prefer for him to be at home, then that's fine with us. There's nothing more we can do. Though if at any stage you would like to have him in hospital, we obviously would take him on. But there's nothing more that we can do for him. So we were happy enough then to keep him at home. And he was delighted to be at home, I know. So it was a lovely week, really, the last week of his life. A strange week, but I think he enjoyed it. It's hard to know in what ways he enjoyed it, but we did everything for him. Anything that he wanted, we would get for him. Any video that he wanted to see, he liked to see the World Cup video, and he loved to hear the Olé Olé song on the tape over and over and over again. He loved that.
In the last days that Peter had with us, which we didn't know were his last days, but days of intensive care, life centred around having enough oxygen for Peter, and seeing that he was able to get enough oxygen from the canisters without turning the pressure up too high.
John Patrick, his brother, was always around, and the other children, when they came home from school, they would all be around him. And it was a lovely time. My mother was here, and together we gave him whatever he might need.
And yet in the last few days, the pressure levels on the oxygen cylinders went from 2, 3, 4 litres per minute, which would be enough for anybody who is needing oxygen badly, with Peter up to 5, 6 litres a minute, and him needing to have the oxygen all the time and being in a considerable state of panic if he couldn't have an immediate switch from one canister to the next.
He loved to have yop and jelly babies, and in fact that was all that he could eat, really. In fact, it was very difficult for him, really, because we had to take the oxygen mask slightly off him, push it to the side, in order to pop in a jelly baby or give him a little sip of yop. And at this stage, it really was just a question of sips and little bites of this and that.
It then got to the point where, when we had to switch canisters, it was a critical matter whether we had it down to a fine art of 5 or 6 seconds or whether we couldn't get the connector undone easily, and there would be a panic, major panic. So we ended up with a huge industrial-sized oxygen cylinder about 5 foot tall downstairs and one upstairs by his bed, both of which ended up on 7-8 litres per minute of a flow.
He had the Christmas party that he wanted the day before he died, and he in fact ate quite a few sweets that we got for him. In another sense, in the spiritual sense, I suppose, it was a lovely week for him in that he made his confirmation on the Tuesday before he died.
When we were at the graveyard, when Peter's coffin was lowered and prayers were said, and then the farewell gestures of Von's mum putting something, a rose, down onto the coffin, which she had been holding, which was on Peter's body, here as he lay in the front room, I then felt that the miracles of somebody bringing a child back to life, that those miracles were not to be for Peter, though they might be for other people, and that finally I would have to say goodbye. And even hearing myself saying the words now, it seems strange to know that his body is in a graveyard a mile or two away, and he is no longer a living part of the family who we will see in the morning or see later at night as we would normally.
And I suppose one of the best places to die in character is at home, among your own, in familiar surroundings. Now, that's very idealistic. The reality for some people is it's not where they want to die. It's not medically possible for them to do that. And it's not possible for their relatives, with all the love and all the goodwill in the world, to give them the kind of care they need. Now, having said that, if a person can die at home, it's now made possible for the family, because I suppose the worries families sometimes have are, you know, will Daddy be in pain? Will he have discomfort? Will we be able to cope? And just to know that you have this tremendous resource, medical resource and human resource behind you, that at 2 o'clock in the morning you can, if you need to, pick up the phone and talk to someone or have somebody come out and treat your dad, is tremendous for the heart. And I have heard people say that not only is it tremendous for their father or their mother, but it was marvellous for themselves, that the time spent with the relatives in the kitchen was equally as important as the time spent upstairs with the person who was dying. And this is where home care can do a tremendous amount, because you cannot just take a relative, a patient, out of a house, out of a home, out of a family, and treat them as if they were related to no one. And home care will tell you this. They will say the unit of care is the patient and the family. So essentially they are doing a very essential task, which is they are enabling the loved ones to care for their own. And at that level, that is a tremendous level of caring.
The freedom of being at home is the wonderful side of it, that that meals appear in a hospital at regular times, and sometimes at times when I wasn't able to eat, and that meal was often missed. But at home I can eat what I like when I like, and tell my family what I like, and it will be available. And it's I find that my appetite has improved now, and is improving quite well since I came out from hospital. But I'm quite sure that wouldn't have happened if I had to remain in the environmental atmosphere of a hospital. And I wouldn't have any hesitation in saying that it's being at home that makes life worth living.